that was a cowardly act. The two deputies were doing their job, minding their own business, watching out for the safety of the people on the train, and seeing somebody just walk up and just start shooting on them, it pisses me off.
LA County Sheriff Alex Villanueva during a news conference Saturday night. After two deputies were shot at point-blank range while they were sitting in their car outside a Compton Metro station, it's not clear why they were targeted. There has been, though, a tremendous amount of tension between the sheriff's department and communities of color across the county. Last month's killing of Dejon Kizzy sparked a wave of protests, and there are concerns of gang activity within the sheriff's office. We're going to talk about all this with Democratic State Assemblyman Reggie Jones-Sawyer. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Now, you represent South LA. You're also chair of the Assembly's Public Safety Committee, and the sheriff was actually quoting you when he described the shooting as a cowardly act. What is your response to this shooting?
And I do believe that was a cowardly act. I'm against police violence. And that's not only police violence when it occurs upon African-Americans, Latinos, but also when violence goes against law enforcement officers. That act was a cowardly act. We're going to find out more why that individual believed they needed to do that. And hopefully we can get some answers. Because ultimately, we need to fix this. An individual that is brazen enough to walk up to an armed law enforcement officer and ambush them probably should not be in society walking among regular citizens. And so that's why we need to apprehend this individual as soon as possible so that we can get to what provoked this. Because it may not have anything to do with what some of the preconceived notions are of what's going on.
Well, speaking of what you just said, preconceived notions, I just want to play another clip from the sheriff where he seems to make a connection, but noting that a suspect has not been arrested yet.
It's a dangerous job. And, you know, actions, words have consequences. And our job does not get any easier because people don't like law enforcement.
So he is saying, perhaps, I don't know with what evidence, that this could have been a motive for the shooting.
I was with the sheriff just right after that happened. He was visibly upset. And again, if you were to ask him now if he believed that this was based on what the Black Lives Matter individuals are working on, what ACLU is working on to improve and get to what we really want is a police renaissance. I think he would say that once we find out what really happened, then we get to the meat of what we need to move on with. But he also needs to know that he needs to move forward with some progressive ideas so that we can move forward with his department that has had several allegations that you've mentioned about. Gangs within the department should not be there. And he said that. And we need to move him toward that in a peaceful way.
Well, speaking of the gangs, there is apparently a gang, according to a whistleblower complaint or several whistleblower complaints, a gang within the Compton station called the Executioners, a gang of sheriff's deputies. And the allegation is that they essentially run the Compton station. But the sheriff has denied that specifically. That there's a gang running any station, but he, as you say, does take these allegations seriously. Do you think there should be a federal investigation into gang activity within the LA County Sheriff's Department?
So let me just start with the young Latino deputy that stepped out and made this report. It is not easy to be a whistleblower. It's definitely not easy to be a whistleblower in a paramilitary institution like law enforcement. And so the fact that we're not totally dismissing that, the fact that the Board of Supervisors would want a full investigation, they are kind of the umbrella organization over the Sheriff's Department. I have confidence that they, along hopefully working with the sheriff, will get to the bottom of this and that we actually know what is actually going on in the Compton Sheriff's Station. That is the most important thing.
But the relationship between the Board of Supervisors and this particular sheriff is that relationship is not very good. And the sheriff has ignored some of the things that the supervisors want him to do. So is it possible for them to mount a credible investigation that could actually get things changed when it comes to this, or does it need to be handled by the feds?
So, I would leave that up to the Board of Supervisors to make that determination on whether or not they need to go ahead and seek federal intervention. We have a different administration right now, and maybe it might make more sense if that administration changes in November to have that type of investigation as opposed to now. It is real important that the federal government, when they're called in, that they do a thorough investigation, but they will need the cooperation of the local elected officials and others to ensure that everyone's treated fairly and that the investigation is done not only thoroughly, but it's done correctly.
Do you trust the Sheriff's Department to undertake a thorough investigation and a credible investigation into the killing of Dejon Kizzee?
A lot of that depends on resources. And again, it goes back to the Board of Supervisors and making sure that if they're going to do it internally, whoever is in charge of it, that they are fully funded and that they have the best people involved, nonpartisan, who can go in and do a thorough examination of what's going on in there. And we're in a budget recession now, and it may get really worse the next coming years.
Finally, I just want to get your take on what happened with our public radio colleague, Josie Wong, a reporter for KPCC, who was violently shoved by sheriff's deputies. She was wounded and then arrested. And a lot of videos are confirming her version of events, as opposed to the sheriff's version, which said she was basically obstructing their work. What do you think about that whole incident? What's your take on it?
In the old days, back then when there was only three channels, that's where you got your news. And all of law enforcement knew one another and the press. Well, that's not the case now. And we also have a lot of bloggers, internet folk who are kind of the press. And so that number has expanded. And we have not updated law enforcement's policies and procedures on how to handle the press. And so this is a perfect example. Look, I have my phone in my hand. I could be a journalist tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And so do I know all the rules and regulations when you come to a crime scene? Absolutely not.
She was wearing her press pass, and she did move away from them when they asked her to move away. So, identify herself as a reporter.
So,
it's clear on the tape. Is there any reason to shove someone to the ground that way, in that forceful way? She was not posing a threat.
I don't know where that provocation would come from, and that is over excessiveness. And so that's what I'm saying. Where are we training our officers to be able to talk through those incidences instead of going to that level? But we've had to make some significant changes on how we interact with one another so these incidents don't happen again.
Well, no, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for coming on to the show today.
You're welcome.
State Assemblyman Reggie Jones Sawyer represents parts of South LA. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the arrest of KPCC's Josie Wong. The Sheriff's Department said in a statement on Twitter that she, quote, did not identify herself as press and charged her with a misdemeanor. But videos, as I mentioned, released by Wong and later on Scene TV show that she repeatedly said she was a reporter with KPCC. You can also see a press ID hanging around her neck. Here to talk about the First Amendment rights of journalists in situations like these is Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Hi.
Hi, Madeline's a hard video to listen to.
It really is, and a hard one to watch. Full disclosure, she used to be a producer on a show that I used to host on KPCC. So with that in mind, can you tell us what her First Amendment rights are in a situation like this, or for any journalist covering a situation like this?
Yeah, absolutely. So journalists in these situations really have the same First Amendment rights as any member of the public. And I thought it was interesting that in your last segment, you had a conversation about really who do we even consider to be a journalist or the press at this moment. But she clearly is a credentialed member of the press. And the answer is you can kind of answer with a hypothetical. Let's say the two of us want to get information on the next Legal Eagle segment, but we have to walk onto somebody else's property without consent. Neither one of us gets to do it. I'm not a member of the press. You are a credentialed member of the press. You don't get to violate the law against trespass just because you have press credentials.
But if I do have press credentials, do I get any privileges that someone who just has a regular cell phone who's filming a situation that that person doesn't have? Do I have something that that person wouldn't have in terms of rights and privileges?
No, there isn't a general journalist privilege. There isn't a general, oh, but I'm working for this media outlet and therefore I should be able to do X, Y, or Z, let's say, for instance, in a protest. So just, you know, members of the press have the same First Amendment rights that would exist for other people who are, as you said, just decide to walk by and have a cell phone, have their cell phone. So they have the same rights and the same protections, kind of no more, no less.
Okay. But what are the rights of the deputies in a situation like this? When they told her to move away, can they do that if she's on a public street? There's no police tape. There's no police line. Like, where is the line for them to tell people where they should be and where they shouldn't be?
Yeah, so there's kind of a couple of different doors here. But let's say that she was not, let's hypothetically say, you know, that she was not in any way obstructing or interfering with what the police were doing, and that the only order was you need to move back. They have a lot of discretion, particularly in those these kind of exigent circumstances. Two sheriff deputies have just been shot. I think it's unclear at this moment, you know, if they have or will survive. And I think they were actually in pursuit of somebody else. So they can say, back up very forcefully and very quickly.
Uh-huh. And then they can charge her with a misdemeanor, which I guess that's what they're planning on doing.
If she fails to comply, right, if it's a lawful order and she fails to comply with that lawful order, then the fact that she, and I mean, again, it's so difficult to listen to, but the fact that she identifies herself as a member of the press, that she says KPCC, KPCC, that doesn't give her any additional legal protection. If they say back up, she has a moment to comply. She doesn't back up. They can at that point arrest.
Well, what about the use of force? They were pretty violent. When you look at the video, it looks pretty like pretty violent situation when you hear her screaming there. And there has been an investigation opened by the inspector general for LA County into this arrest. If her version of the events is upheld, what kind of repercussions would the deputies face?
Yeah, so the deputies could face anything from excessive use of force, if it really is deemed to be excessive use of force, to they could have violated, for instance, internal sheriff's procedures. In this case, you know, it's the video is confusing and it's clear that they weren't gentle with her. But I think that it's good that they are going to open an investigation. There's a lot of video footage and look at exactly what happened. But the main thing that you would be looking at in this case is, did they use more force than is necessary? You know, I've talked about this before, more force than is necessary in that moment. It's not a bright line rule.
Okay, let us turn to another story in the news. Late last week, an appeals court reinstated a Florida law that requires former felons to pay outstanding fines they have to the state in order to have their voting rights reinstated. What is going on there? Is that, I mean, the lower court argued that requiring them to pay these fees was basically like a poll tax, which is unconstitutional. What did the appeals court say in reversing that decision?
Yeah, what the appeals court said is that you have to, if the state can say, if you were convicted of a felony, here are the circumstances, here are the terms under which you can get your voting rights back, and serving a complete term or the requirements to get your voting rights back, that can include paying fines or fees. So what the appeals court said is there's no violation of the 14th Amendment equal protection, and that states have broad latitude, again, to say, sure, you can register to vote if you were convicted of a felony, as long as you've satisfied the terms of your sentence, and that part of the terms of your sentence, again, can be these fees or fines.
But the Florida voters approved this measure to amend their constitution to restore voting rights to former felons. And was there any mention of paying these fees?
No. So this is what, there's this really interesting dance between what the Florida voters did in 2018. They passed this amendment. They amended the Constitution to allow convicted felons to vote after they serve their sentences and they're off parole. Florida at that point, I think, was one of three states that did not provide that kind of path to allow people to get their voting rights back. But then a year later, Florida passes this law, the legislature passes this law, which they say is clarifying the amendment. But the law, in fact, makes it more difficult for felons to be able to register to vote because it says, yeah, we're clarifying that amendment. And the clarification is that you have to pay all your fees and fines. Now, what does this mean in practice? Of course, that it will be much more difficult for people who are convicted of felonies who are now off parole to be able to register. So as you said, the district court said, absolutely not. This is an unconstitutional, it functions as a poll tax. The 11th Court of Appeals in a 6-4 decision said just what we've been talking about, which is no, actually this is permissible because this is just part of the term of your sentence. Mm-hmm. Five of the six members of the court who are in the majority were appointed by President Trump. Shows you how important it is who gets to appoint federal judges.
Yeah, and 800,000 potential voters in play there. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, why the fires raging on the West Coast are just the beginning. A climate scientist tells us what to expect in the coming years. Next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. President Trump is in Northern California today, meeting with Governor Newsom about the wildfires. More than 3 million acres have burned in California so far this year. In Oregon, more than 1 million acres. And we're only in the middle of September. Fire season is just getting started. The air quality in Los Angeles is at unhealthy levels not seen in decades. And the fire known as the Bobcat Fire has led to evacuation orders in parts of Arcadia and Sierra Madre. So why has this fire season been this extreme this early, and what might the next few months look like? Here to talk about this is Kim Cobb, professor of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I guess the answer to my question is climate change, right?
Well, yes, there's a really important climate story here. Obviously, there's also a weather story here. What we've been looking at is a steady march of warmer temperatures, making fires like this much more likely. And of course, prior to these fires, we had record-breaking temperatures gripping much of California. And now, of course, we're plunged into a scenario where the fires are poorly contained, and we're looking to weather patterns for relief in the near term.
Well, how do you tease apart weather from climate change. Aren't they intimately related?
Well, yes and no. Obviously, what shows up on any given year is really determined by, you know, what the atmosphere has to dish out that particular year. When and where these extremes are going to occur is in some way anybody's guess. But what the science is very, very clear on is that the warmer temperatures that are marching forward, and of course only going to get worse in the coming decades, are really tied to large-scale drought across the American West. And of course, when you have that moisture stress combined with the acute temperatures like we had this summer, you're going to get conditions which are just ripe for massive devastation by wildfires. So really the steady march of fire-prone conditions has been identified as a culprit in the severity of these fires, with that extra added punch of extreme fire risk added by those ridiculously warm temperatures earlier this month.
Right. So we saw just the weekend before these fires broke out, 121 degrees in Woodland Hills in the valley here, which is crazy, obviously record breaking. Is that something that we're going to have to start getting used to seeing in the coming years?
Oh, yes. I mean, we may not see that in your community every single year, right? As I've said, these extremes are popping up with alarming frequency all across this country and frankly around the world. And even for folks like me that have pored over the climate impact reports noting that these extremes are going to increase dramatically, you know, seeing the thermometers, feeling the heat, listening to people suffering through it is a whole different level of realism, if you will. So unfortunately, yes, these kinds of heat extremes are only going to get worse. And this is something that science has been talking about for a long time. And of course, we are overdue in the preparations we need to keep people safe from these kinds of devastating extremes.
So you've been talking about it for a while, and we have been talking about climate change for a while. Here it is, and we're living with it. Do you think the fact that, you know, so many people are suffering, it just is apocalyptic out there, the air is unbelievably bad, the air quality is unbelievably bad, that this will finally prompt people to take major change?
Well, you know, as you so well know, and as your listeners know as well, this is a national level conversation that requires national level action. In fact, California has been leading on climate at the forefront, enacting policies to reduce their emissions and keep communities safe for quite some time now. If we're really to get serious about this, we need a national level program to help keep communities safe from the impacts that we have today, while recognizing and working towards collective goals to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. Without this combination enacted in federal policy driven by national level recognition, this is important. Unfortunately, we're going to continue to be ill prepared and unnecessarily exposed, and not now also, but in the decades to come.
What about this idea the president keeps talking about, that poor forest management is the main cause of these fires? Even though most of this land is federally managed, he keeps talking about thinning the forests. Is there something to be said for that, that that's part of why we have these devastating fires?
Well, I do think that science has pointed to these risk factors for a very, very, very long time. And as a scientist, I'm here to say that I think science will provide many of the solutions. So that includes preparing communities to manage forests in a way that can be less risk prone during these increasingly fire prone seasons. That also must include a focus on reducing our greenhouse gases so that we do not face the prospect for accelerating climate change over the next decades. There's only so much you're going to be able to do on the ground, if you will, in terms of keeping people and property safe. But again, science does provide a framework for reaching for best practices. And it's quite clear that in meeting the demands of these extremely fire-prone regions, we're going to need a new toolkit that will very likely involve a really advanced set of climate-ready forestry management tools.
How reversible is what we're seeing? Is the, you know, cow out of the barn, so to speak? Are we going to have to just try to mitigate the higher temperatures and the climate change that we're seeing now going forward, or is there a way to reverse it, to dial it back?
Well, that's a great question. People always ask me, what's the one thing you wish that people knew about climate change? And the one thing that I wish people would know is that we could be cooling the planet by 2050 if we wanted to. Now, there's good news and bad news in this. My students look at me and say, I'll take that, I'll fight for that, and I'm there with them. But the bad news is that we are going to be warming over the next decade, two, and possibly three, if we get very serious about climate change. So the story is one of preparing for worsening impacts to come using the best available science that we have at our fingertips, while, of course, working as fast as we can to recover time on what we should have been doing a decade ago and weaning ourselves off fossil fuels and embracing a clean energy economy.
So what you're saying is that for the next 30 years, it's going to be bad. It's going to be warm no matter what we do, but hopefully we can start turning things around in 2050.
Well, you know, cooling by 2050 means that we have to stop warming first. So, you know, we've already, to put it in concrete terms, we've already warmed possibly just over 1 degree Celsius on our global planetary experiment called global warming here. And if we allow ourselves to breach the 1.5 degrees Celsius limit that the Paris Accords have laid out as our most ambitious target, then we'll obviously be embracing a world that in very many ways looks quite different than the one we're sitting in, even in 2020. So, you know, the time is short. We have about a decade to make significant progress towards the 2050 carbon neutral goal and begin to reverse this problem. But you can rest assured that the kind of impacts we've seen here in 2020 are exactly a taste of what we should expect to worsen in the coming decade or two for sure.
Kim Cobb is a professor of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Georgia Tech. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. Stay safe.
Well, speaking of dystopian futures, writer Margaret Atwood has thoughts on that.
My novels are not slices of joy, happiness, and skipping about.
No.
They are fairly bleak in places, although I put in some jokes. But I haven't ever killed everybody off at the end.
We'll talk about The Handmaid's Tale and her new sequel next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
She is out there planning who knows what kind of atrocities to visit upon our righteous nation. I never allowed myself to see her for what she clearly is, beyond redemption.
That's Aunt Lydia, speaking of a Fred, in the trailer for the forthcoming season of The Handmaid's Tale series on Hulu. Well, last we left off, a Fred helped a couple dozen young girls escape Gilead, that righteous nation Aunt Lydia was referring to, where women are kept as fertility slaves and dissenters are hung in public squares. And as we await season four of the TV series, based on the novel by Margaret Atwood, Margaret Atwood has given us a long-awaited sequel to the book. It's called The Testaments, and it's out now in paperback, and it picks up 15 years after the end of The Handmaid's Tale. In it, we learn more about Aunt Lydia, and we meet two young women, one growing up in the theocratic dictatorship of Gilead, the other, free, growing up across the border in Canada. And Margaret Atwood joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, why did you begin writing The Testaments in 2016, decades
Indeed.
After you finished writing The Handmaid's Tale? What prompted you to think, okay, now finally I need to write a sequel to this?
Yeah, I think it was a change in world affairs. So I wrote Handmaid's Tale in the middle of the 1980s. So the 70s had been a lot of ferment and change, and so had the 60s. And the 80s was a decade of pushback. And that's when the religious right started saying things like women belong in the home. So one of my questions to myself was, okay, how do you step them back in? They're all out running around doing things like having radio shows. How do you make them stop doing that? Stuff them back into the home and make them stay there? Well, of course, the first thing you would do would be to cancel their credit cards, would it not? So I started thinking my way through that. And I also wondered to myself what kind of totalitarianism might the United States be if it were to become one. But then we had the 90s, the end of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War. And the 90s was more like triumph of capitalism, globalization, let's go shopping. Mm-hmm. And that thinking ended at 9/11. And then things started getting more polarized and conservative because people get more conservative when they get scared. So it seemed to me that things were starting to feel more like the 30s than I could remember in my lifetime, which has been long. So I thought, all right, maybe we should go and look at Gilead as it evolves into its future years. We know it ended because we were told that in The Handmaid's Tale, but we weren't told how it ended. So maybe we should look at what's happening in it 15, 16 years into the future beyond Handmaid's Tale. So I thought, let's take a look at Aunt Lydia. So how does somebody who can never be a top leader, somebody who's ambitious and has some power within the system, but can never be the leader of the system because a woman would never be allowed to be a leader of that system. How is she getting on with all of this? And how did she get there in the first place?
So we find out that she used to be a judge before.
A family court judge. I know one of those. It's a pretty hard job.
Yeah, it is a really hard job. And you were dealing with, you know, the women's sphere, if you will, the home, the family. And
yeah, so naturally they would put somebody like that into a job like hers.
Right, which is all about controlling women and children. It's just really interesting to hear her voice and to hear her tell her story and to try to understand her, because we've known her as just a villain. We haven't known her perspective. It was told through the eyes of Offred and, you know, through her eyes, of course, she's a villain. And so how did you go about trying to think about Aunt Lydia as a full human and humanize her as a person who has conflicting desires, conflicting motivations, as someone who can encapsulate both good and evil?
Well, it helps to read about other villains.
Yeah.
Starting with Richard III. So one of the things I like about Richard III, the play, is that he comes right out in the prologue and says, I'm bad. And I'm also pissed off at all of these other people, so watch me. That's what he says. Hmm. So I've always been interested in people who have considerable knowledge of themselves and know what they are capable of, but who might also have a change of direction fairly far into their villainous careers. And that has happened. As you know, I put nothing into these books that does not have a precedent in real life. So I also read about quite a few double agents and people who had done undercover things because they disagreed with the system they found themselves in.
I'm going to ask a question now. And if listeners, if you haven't read the Testaments and you want to read it, now's the time to turn the volume down, because I'm going to ask a spoiler question.
Oh, I may not answer it if it's too much of a spoiler.
Okay. Well, let's give it a whirl. I'm really interested in exactly what makes Aunt Lydia do that. What makes her turn against the regime that she has thrived in?
She's getting old. So believe it or not, a lot of old people become more risk-taking as they go on, because They don't have a lot of future to lose, number one. Number two, people have treated her badly at the beginning of Gilead, and she's never forgotten that. She's going to get them back. She says, once a judge, always a judge. She has judged them. So revenge is one of her motivations. It's a very human tendency. I don't applaud it, but we are vengeful. We like to see somebody get their comeuppance. So she has a little list. So that's another one of her motivations. And read on, dear reader.
Yes, and dare I say she is a closet feminist, that she does believe in equal rights for women.
Yeah, she was one of those before Gilead came in, and of course you had to adjust your ideas pretty rapidly. But her choice at the beginning of it was go along with us and help us out, or bullet in the head. So what would you do?
Yeah, you would try to do everything to survive.
You might think that's a bridge too far. I'm going to go now. So bullet in the head, that's my choice. Hmm. And a number of the people that we see in that in early scene in her life, that's the choice they've made. But that is not the choice she makes.
You wrote an essay in 2017 in the New York Times, a few months after President Trump was inaugurated. And you wrote about what your book means in the age of Trump. That's the headline mm-hmm. of the essay. And there's a part of it where you write that there is a literary form that you wanted to highlight, and that is the literature of witness.
Michael.
That Ufred records her story, she hides it, and she trusts it may be discovered mm-hmm. by someone who's free to understand it and share it. And you write, this is an act of hope. Mm-hmm. And every recorded story implies a future reader.
Yeah. It is an act of hope to record a story that a future reader will have access to, because you're assuming that will be possible. And similarly with the testaments, Lydia is, and it's not much of a spoiler because you find it out in about the first three pages, she is similarly recording her story and hiding it. And that too supposes a future reader.
I'm wondering, though, when you apply this to the present, to real life, where there's so much recording of stories and people's opinions and what they think and what they've done and what they will do, and their books and tweets and all sorts of expressions going on.
Yeah,
that it's not necessarily a question of whether or not people will write and read. It's a question of interpretation. And even if you are recording your story, will people believe it?
Well, there again, it's an act of hope to suppose that they will. Is it not? Mm. So I think the accounts that we are going to be interested in, or that people are going to be interested in, are first person accounts. This is what happened today to me. It might be like that. There is a pretty famous diary that was kept during the 30s by a man who was not a liberal. He wasn't. He was an old conservative kind of guy, but he just hated the Nazis. And he was writing this account of what was happening and his feelings about what was happening as it was all taking place. And that's pretty darn interesting. They caught him in the end and shot him, but his manuscript survived. But there are a lot of those in history. People who have managed to get their story out under very difficult conditions. And who knows how many other manuscripts and accounts were written but didn't make it out.
Yeah. Also, though, I mean, it presupposes that people will agree that what you're saying is the truth, right?
Well, some people will and others won't.
Yeah.
It's always the way. It will depend on, because readers too are individual, singular human beings, and they have different points of view. And what they think, what they are going to think of the past, namely our present, will partly depend on what the future turns out to be. And we can't predict that because there isn't one, the future. There are multiple possible futures, and we don't know which way the cat is going to jump. So although the future we get is going to depend on the decisions we make now, we do not know whether the results of our decisions are going to be positive or negative.
Well, you are hopeful, and you're hopeful in your novels as well, or at least you're hopeful on the page, yeah, and it sounds like you're hopeful in real life too.
My novels are not slices of joy, happiness, and skipping about.
No.
They are fairly bleak in places, although I put in some jokes. But I haven't ever killed everybody off at the end. Not everybody. That would be pretty sad, would it not?
Well, someone has to survive to tell the tale.
Somebody has to survive to listen to the tale.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure, and I'm a big fan, so thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's Margaret Atwood. She's the author of The Handmaid's Tale and The Testaments, among many other works of fiction and nonfiction. The Testaments is available in paperback now, and Margaret Atwood will be in conversation with Bradley Whitford, who plays Lawrence in The Handmaid's Tale TV series, for a Writer's Block event tomorrow. More information at writersblockpresents.com. Coming up, Free Britney. What's behind the move to wrest control of Britney Spears' estate away from her father? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Can you believe that song came out more than 20 years ago? Britney Spears was just 17 years old. Well, since then, we have all witnessed her ups and downs, the shaved head, the suicide threat, the hospitalizations. During all that, a court appointed her father to be her conservator, meaning he controls her nearly $60 million estate. However, last year, he stepped away from managing her estate to deal with his own health issues. Now, at age 38, Britney Spears is fighting to keep her father from returning. She's fighting him in court, and the legal fight has energized the online Free Britney movement. Her fans also show up outside the Stanley Moss Courthouse in Los Angeles to support her whenever there's a hearing. Here to talk about Britney and celebrity conservatorship is Madison Malone Kircher, senior writer for New York Magazine. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So right now, a woman named Jody Montgomery is in control of Britney's finances. Who is she?
Jody Montgomery is a caretaker of Britney Spears who has been working with her for years. And Britney's lawyer has written that Britney, quote unquote, strongly prefers keeping Jody as the person overseeing her well-being, her mental health, her physical health permanently, as opposed to her father, Jamie.
So what does conservatorship entail exactly when it comes to Britney?
The easiest way to describe it is, the obvious example is, you think about an elderly relative, right? Somebody who no longer has the mental and physical faculties to take care of themselves, to manage their money, to manage their health. And that person would be put under a conservatorship. Britney Spears was placed under her conservatorship in her late 20s in 2008. As you mentioned, that was the year of the infamous head shaving. She was placed on an involuntary psych hold. And from that point on, Britney Spears no longer had control over her own life. Not her health decisions, not what she spends money on, reportedly not what she posts online. Ostensibly, every element of her life is controlled by someone else.
So now, how is she? Now she's 38. Is she back in control mentally? Is she not suffering any breakdowns? Can she resume control of her finances, of everything else in her life?
You know, that's something only Brittany can say, but via documents that have leaked from the court and her attorney, based on Brittany's wishes for the conservatorship going forward, it seems like she is looking for changes, for more freedom, for something to change. Her brother Brian spoke out on a podcast in July saying that she had, quote, always wanted to get out of the conservatorship. And more recently, filings from her lawyer, obtained by, I believe, TMZ, argue that she doesn't have medical or sensitive issues that need to be protected anymore. So these hearings need to be happening in public. That's a really interesting detail of Brittany's conservatorship, is that a judge agreed to seal all of the court proceedings. So the public has no idea what is going on, which could be great if you're somebody like Britney Spears, who's been mega world famous since you were 17 years old and really do need help and privacy. But if what the conspiracy theories are saying are true and that Britney is trying to get out of this, it's not very helpful if you've got a closed door when you're saying, I need help.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so she's taken to talking about some of this online, and there are all sorts of other people talking about her online. She really does have quite a public profile. So, but I want to play a clip from a few months ago where, I don't know, it seems a little like maybe she's not exactly 100%.
Hi guys, I'm in my gym right now. I haven't been in here for like 6 months because I burnt my gym down, unfortunately. I had two candles and yeah, one thing led to another and I burned it down. So I'm in here and I only have two pieces of equipment left, and I'm going to show you guys what I do during this time.
Okay, I
knew you were going to play the gym burning down clip. First of all, yeah. I just need like the TikTok on how Britney Spears burnt down her gym.
Is there one?
There isn't, but I would read one immediately.
Yeah.
I agree, right? That's a video clip that doesn't make you feel all that confident that Britney Spears is in a position to manage herself and take care of herself. But you watch other clips. More recently, there was a clip where Britney posted a video saying, you know, so many of you ask questions in the comments and I want to answer your questions. And then proceeded to give a lot of very strange answers about how much she loves the movie Frozen, which only prompted commenters to say, this is not what we were asking. Are you okay? This seems like the sort of video you post when you're being made to post content that says you are fine.
Oh my gosh. So with the Frozen incident, was she basically, were people saying she's signaling, she's trying to send a message that she's trapped,
yes,
just like Elsa? And
ding, ding, ding.
Okay. I guess so. People are parsing this, but is the judge in this case parsing this in order to decide whether to grant her back her control over her life?
So the thing about the Free Britney movement that has sort of been interesting is that well-intentioned fans clamoring for Britney, who love Britney, who want the best for Britney, have almost hurt her actual court proceedings. This summer, a hearing on her conservatorship status was unable to take place because the Zoom call, which was supposed to be confidential, was Zoom bombed, which is to say people who were not involved in the ongoing case crashed it and the proceedings could not happen with those people on the line. So the court date has now been pushed. Britney's conservatorship will remain as it is until February of next year.
And again, she wants this other woman to be the conservator. She doesn't necessarily want to regain sole control over her finances and everything else.
No, correct. And according to other documents that have leaked and been reported by outlets, she's looking for a bank or some kind of financial institution to take over the money aspect of her conservatorship rather than her father.
But this idea of conservatorship of celebrities, it's not just Britney. There's also Amanda Bynes, and some people have been talking about maybe Kanye, Kim Kardashian having conservatorship over him because of his behavior. This is obviously not isolated. Maybe Britney Spears is the most famous example of it, but does this happen frequently when stars go into have some kind of mental breakdown?
Not terribly infrequently, but I think Amanda Bynes, who you mentioned, is a really excellent example. So Amanda Bynes was placed on multiple involuntary psych holds in 2013, 2014, and then was placed under a conservatorship with her mother designated as guardian. Since that time, Amanda Bynes has been diagnosed with bipolar and manic depressive disorder, has been vocal in some interviews about working on living with those conditions. She graduated from fashion school. Her conservatorship was extended in 2018 for another 2 years, but in 2017, she regained financial control of her life. Her mother still has some control through the conservatorship, but it has evolved and changed and grown with Amanda Bynes' needs. And that's what a conservatorship should, in theory, be doing. What you hear the Free Britney movement saying is Britney's not getting that chance, that treatment.
Well, thanks so much for updating us.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to go listen to Toxic.
That is a great idea. Madison Malone Kircher, senior writer for New York Magazine. A classic and worth it. Great song. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to our podcast whenever you want and listen to it whenever you want at kcrw.com/pressplay. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow. It's getting late.